to CPRcommunitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. September will see the largest war games by Russia and the U.S. since the Cold War. We spoke about that and what it means with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University in International Affairs, via Skype from Moscow Friday.
It's all about the Dragon Bear, baby.
Dragon Bear is on.
Dragon Bear is on. So we're talking about upcoming. It's actually already started here in Russia. It will be carrying on for another 2 weeks, just a little bit over 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. The Vostok 2018 military exercises, Russia puts on since the 90s, Russia has put on four major military exercises generally a year, and they are. Come to the heart of the military drills that Russia is doing. It is all about self-defense, survival of the state, wow. Or when it feels the need, the projection of military force in one of its four cardinal directions, right on its periphery. Right, if you know, it sees a regime change, or a military incursion into one of the countries that it sees as its red line interests, right on its borders, and these are ZAPID, which is the West, obviously, right. Where we saw some fairly large military drills in the last year with Belarus. That had NATO all worked up and exaggerating the scale of them. There is the Central Military Exercises. There is the Caucasus, which is Russia's south, right? And it is always a concern and a flashpoint because of Islamic jihadism and tensions with Georgia, Armenian, Azerbaijani tensions, which would you know, almost inevitably draw Russia in one form or another to a major conflict, and so on. And then there's the East, Vostok. That's what Vostok means. It is the East in Russian. And these drills are significant because they're being billed as the largest military drills that Russia has had since 1981 with the Soviet Union. If the numbers that the Russian military are giving out are accurate, they may be the largest military drills that Russia has ever really had.
Yeah, the one in the Zapad 81, apparently the estimates were 100 to 150,000 troops, and they're saying now about 300,000, right?
About 300,000. Now, to be let's be fair, Russia has, to a spirit of the degree, over-exaggerated the troop strength of some of its exercises, because these are often including the numbers of troops, say, in the Central Military District and elsewhere, that may just be putting on active status, may run out to one small location or something like that, may go through, but aren't actively involved in actual military on-the-field exercises themselves.
Right.
So take that number with a grain of salt. Let's see what really comes out of it.
Well, you know, the ones that are
the outside observers there.
Whoever's cutting potatoes, I mean, they would also be counted in a real battlefield because they'd be cutting potatoes there too. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah. So it certainly we can expect in excess of 150,000. And let's see, that's already huge. And let's go from there. Now, the scale of this exercise really shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, because in recent years, we have seen back and forth biggest military exercises since the Cold War between NATO and Russia for several years now. NATO puts on the largest military exercises they've ever done since the Cold War. Russia puts them on, NATO puts them on, and so on. In October, we'll see NATO put on Trident Juncture, which will be the largest military exercises that NATO has ever performed in Norway. In the past few years, we've seen several military drills, the most recent Anaconda, which is a military annual military drill, semi-annual, which takes place in Poland and the surrounding countries, and that was over 100,000 NATO troops. So this is a back and forth, and it is a progression of saber rattling. It is a logical outcome, and the Vostok is certainly the latest in this series. Now, what is unusual about this military exercise, other than the size, is who's participating in it. It's not just Russia. For the first time, China is participating in one of these large Russian national security drills.
Yep.
And the People's Liberation Army is sending 3,200 troops to participate, along with about 30 fixed-wing aircraft and several hundred tanks and armored vehicles. And Mongolia will also be participating. I haven't seen any exact numbers, and I don't expect it would be very huge. Right. But this you can see as a big Northeast Asia military exercise, showing interoperability, showing coordination, and of course sending the political signal of being united against outside threats. Now, there are some people, some hacks who present themselves as analysts in the Western media, saying some things like, oh, Russia's putting this drill on in the East because they don't want to appear threatening to China or something. Oh, that's nonsense. This is one of a scheduled annual exercises that always takes place in the East.
Right. And it comes in the context of the announcement by both Putin and Xi of a strategic partnership. Right? It doesn't get much more strategic than this.
And Russia and China have put on several, every year, for several years now, for nearly a decade, they've been putting on joint military exercises that do get bigger and ever more complicated. Most of them happening under the aegis of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, sometimes with other partner countries. There is a military exercise going on right now as well, Peace Mission 2018, which has, and that's under the auspices of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, much smaller. But far more interestingly, that is being conducted with Russia, China, Kazakhstan, India, and Pakistan.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
It is the first time that India and Pakistan have ever exercised, done military drills together.
Well, when they do them, usually they're shooting at each other.
Yeah. Not that kind of military exercise.
Right.
And even Newsweek says Russia had an article out about how Russia has gotten, because of Russia, India and Pakistan are having drills together. Presumably on the same side in some theoretical conflict, as hard as that is for anyone, including me, to believe.
To imagine.
So we've seen these increasing, particularly between Russia and China, sometimes with the SCO, sometimes bilaterally. We've seen Russia participate in naval drills off the Taiwan Straits together, Russian, right? A lot of people forget that Russia is also a Pacific power. It certainly can't go toe-to-toe with the U.S. fleet, or certainly not with Japan and South Korea as well, which both have significant militaries out there.
It doesn't have to.
Yeah. China's naval fleet is growing by leaps and bounds. They're doing sea trials on their second carrier now. Within 10 years, they'll probably have three or four more of them, which is huge. It is such game-changing. That, the acquisition of Russian air defense systems, the most advanced surface-to-ship missiles, the growing number of Chinese submarines in the Pacific. Russia is building up their own submarine fleet, rebuilding it up fairly significantly as well. A lot of U.S. naval planners really concerned about that, because Russia does subs very well, even despite the smaller number. Right. But Russia and the Chinese fleet, Russia joining China in any Pacific conflict involving the United States and any other Pacific powers, South Korea, Japan, possibly Australia. The U.S. keeps trying to draw India. They're now calling it the Indo-Pacific. This is their new geopolitical buzzword they're drawing around. I'm not quite sure how far China is biting at that particular bit of bait.
Right.
In any potential future conflict, Russia, the Russian fleet entering the side of China in the Pacific, could be a game changer. It certainly would provide China with a lot more possibility of, because, yeah, I mean, the U.S. obviously has a much bigger fleet, and especially combined with South Korea and Japan for carriers, everything, but you have to presume that any future conflict will not be China attacking the United States, right? That would be like hundreds of years in the future, or and so on. It would be the U.S. projecting force into the Taiwanese Straits or elsewhere in the South China Sea, and the addition of the Russian fleet there could play all the difference between what the U.S. could actually bring to bear on the other side of the Pacific like that.
Right. You can use that naval force to project into the water, but you've got the land there already, so you don't need 50 aircraft carriers or whatever. You've got airports.
Right. You can project air and surface to ship missiles and so on. So it's a different that is where everyone plans for future conflict, including the United States. Right. They're not preparing for China to attack Pearl Harbor. That no one is, that would be interesting bit of sci-fi militarism. Tom Clancy could have been great, but it's not realistic, right? Yeah. This is what we're talking about. We're talking basically about the naval coastal defense.
That's right.
Of Eurasia. In particular, China and their zone of interest right out in their own back pond, as it were. Now, So the naval drills are continuing in this. In the last just over a year, Russia and China have also been doing joint ballistic missile defense exercises. That should send off signals, right? You don't do joint your ballistic missile defense is your most important national security concern when dealing with other great powers. You don't invite one of the other big nuclear powers into your drills unless you're serious about how far allied you are with these countries.
Right. And what does strategic partnership mean to you? If strategic partnership means this, then it means something. Yeah.
Basically, they're saying that if there is a nuclear conflict that starts to, you know, spread out and consume most countries, Russia and China know they're going to be on each other's side.
That's right. Now, you know, there's something else I'm looking at here that's real interesting. And I've seen, I mean, you know, you're on top of this, so I want to run this by you. I saw, like, something about, well, gee, the West hadn't really counted on the advances that Russia has made in its ability to project power through the Arctic Ocean. And, you know, in terms of military movement over and through the Arctic Ocean. I'm looking at the globe tilted that way, where you have North America facing off Russia with China behind Russia, and looking at that as a battlefield, you know, other than the conventional ones that we think of. And these kinds of drills taking place in, you know, in Asia rather than in Western Europe make perfect sense in that scenario.
I mean... The Arctic has been neglected, of course, since the end of the Cold War, and always was to a certain extent by the North. You know, you can easily forget that the U.S. and Russia are, you know, a couple kilometers apart at the Bering Straits.
Right.
You know, and it continues that close proximity. An actual nuclear exchange, of course, if you look at a map between U.S. and Russia, is going to be missiles fired over the North Pole at each other.
That's why NORAD used to.
So. Russia has, you know, they have much more focused national security and power projection interests, right? Russia knows that its geopolitical horizons are much smaller than were the Soviet Union. Russia concentrates on defending itself and is working now on the ability to project force, again, into its near periphery. They're not looking as the U.S. is facing classic imperial overstretch.
Right.
They've got over 1,000 military bases around the world. They have to simultaneously worry about conflicts in the Middle East, conflicts in the South China Sea, now conflicts in Europe, in the Mediterranean, and in the Black Sea. They're trying to project power all over the place at the same time. And it stretches their forces really thin, whereas Russia has the ability to concentrate on certain things. And one of the main areas that Russia has concentrated on, of course, is the Arctic, because they've got claims to expand the range of what is considered their territory in the Arctic that is up for scientific review and consideration at the UN. And, of course, there's a lot of oil and gas there.
Russia has more coast there, too, than anybody else has of anything in the world. They have more coast.
Yeah, Russia already has more of the Arctic that is its, you know, national and economic territory more than anyone else. And that is only set to grow. And Russia is well aware, of something that is somehow politically debated in the U.S. as if there's any question to it, of the realities of climate change and that the Arctic is warming. They are counting on, several things with regard to that. One of them is that oil and gas resources will be more easier in the future, more accessible, easier to get, whether that's through the seafloor or elsewhere in the Arctic. Another one is that the northern trade route will soon become a reality.
Right.
We've already seen several ships make the passage across the north without icebreakers in the summer.
Right. I mean, you've got a convergence of technology and warming that are making
that
more possible.
That is going to be the thing. And, in the winter, you will still see ice for several decades. right? And in that time of the year, icebreakers, you know, for any extent into the Arctic, and still largely in the summer, you know, for the next, 10 or 15 years, you need icebreakers. And Russia is the only country that really has military icebreakers, period. And Russia has nuclear-powered icebreakers and is building more of them. And these are essential to projecting naval force in the Arctic. Russia is also building floating nuclear power stations that are meant to be deployed to oil and gas and military installations in the Arctic. Mm. So Russia's really getting ready to play in the Arctic the way no other country can or will. I mean, if you take a look, the U.S. barely has any borders on the Arctic, and actually its biggest legal territorial disputes in the Arctic are with Canada.
Right.
They've got serious legal disputes with Canada. The same thing between Denmark and Canada. Russia and Norway have actually largely settled their legal boundary disputes, although of course everyone contests each other's expansion into greater Arctic territory, the land extension claims there. But Canada, their population of Canada is much more centered, almost entirely along their border
with the US.
United States.
That's right.
So it's a big empty Arctic territory.
Right.
Whereas the Soviet Union pretty much forcibly moved populations into the Arctic to form actual cities there, Murmansk, et cetera, across the top, and has a much larger portion of its population and infrastructure in the Arctic. This is good and bad. Russia is seeing its pipelines and many of its, cities' buildings start to suffer major infrastructure damage as the permafrost starts to melt on a regular basis because of climate change. They're seeing huge methane gas bubbles exploding on land, creating gigantic sinkholes, as well as off the coast in the water, right? And, Russia actually sees more of climate change right now than almost any country in the world, except for the few Pacific Island little microstates that are already going underwater.
Again, it has more coastline than anybody else.
In the Arctic. So Russia's preparing in the Arctic, they right now you can say that is one sphere of potential Russian conflict. Russia would dominate in that particular geographic area. And China is looking at actually becoming a player there as a lesser partner of Russia, much like Russia's willing to become a lesser partner to China in other parts, including Asia. Another thing that is happening with this military drill is it's sending a political signal about North Korea, because obviously this is happening. This drill is going on in the Transbaikal region. It's in, this northeastern Asian sector. And, part of it is preparation. Part of it is maybe a little bit of deterrence, letting the U.S. know that Russia and China are showing military unity and the ability to conduct exercises in what is, pretty far-flung territory, for both of them. And the potential for destabilization of North Korea, collapse of the regime, airstrikes that the U.S. may conduct on North Korea that could escalate into something else entirely. Russia and China are ready to defend their own backyard there, certainly for stabilization operations and whatever else they find necessary, which would depend on what the U.S. is, absolutely insane scenarios like the U.S. invading North Korea, which, even I can't see. But yet in military, you prepare for contingencies. And the U.S. is fading as in its ability to project power in Asia. Russia and China, the other great powers, Iran, they're all combining you know, with each other under pressure from the United States. They're unifying politically and militarily, and they're providing area denial. Which is what military strategists, particularly in the U.S., talk about, are concerned about, particularly with things like the S-400, you know, the Russian, which is the best air defense system in the world, is their ability to access and project power into far-flung areas of the globe. And they're losing that ability in Eurasia. They've lost in Afghanistan, and now all they're talking about is how to withdraw, right? Afghanistan has proven once again to be the graveyard of empires The U.S. It's, you know, the longest conflict in its history fading out there. China is very close to gaining the upper hand in the South China Sea, in the Taiwanese Straits, in the South China Sea. Yep. And within 10 years, that will be a de facto that the U.S. would lose there. That's serious. And that's really pushing the U.S. That is why a North Korean and South Korean unification also presents a geopolitical threat, because right. that could demand the withdrawal of U.S. troops from North Korea, which would lead to complications from with South Japan. Yep, and right. there's always indigenous movements in Japan, Okinawa, and elsewhere that flare up every once in a while, wanting to kick the U.S. out of their military bases, their entrenchment.
You've got also like a little bit of a fever of imperial retreat inside the White House right now, too. Trump has been looking at NATO and Japan and others, saying, pay for your own defense. And I don't care if you get a nuclear weapon or whatever. You defend yourself and we'll help you, maybe.
That would actually be the smartest thing, right?
Yeah, of course.
Some retrenchment, some recognition that the U.S. is facing imperial overstretch,
right.
that a multipolar world is dawning. And some of this is actually seen, and Vostok is also a response to this, in the U.S. national security strategy, the shift away from a terrorism and non-state actor focus to recognizing that great power conflict is now the biggest national security threat, once again, the biggest national security conflict. And, of course, that means largely Russia and China, you know, possibly Iran, but it really means Russia and China. And Russia and China are showing that in response. And to show you how far we've come, you have to remember that in the very beginning of the Cold War, Russia, communist Russia and China, of course, were allied. That broke down. And by the late 1960s, you had communist powers, you know, People's Republic of China and the Soviet Union in conflict with each other.
Yeah, they had border wars. Yep.
That's not talked about much, even in history books.
Yep.
A series of small conflicts that had every potential to grow up into a gigantic conflagration. Thank God it didn't.
Right.
With a not insignificant loss of life, particularly on the Chinese side.
Right.
That led right into Nixon and Kissinger's splitting of China. Completely politically, diplomatically, out of the Soviet camp into kind of an adjunct to the Western camp.
Right, that's right.
And in my view, that won the Cold War.
That's right.
That was at that point, that was the deciding. Now things have gone far back the other way, and Kissinger told Nixon back then that if your successor is smart, in 20 years, he'll swing the other way and side with Russia against China. That never happened, of course, and that leads us up, the collapse of the Soviet Union up to where we are today, where Russia and China can't be split apart anymore. Relations have improved so much. It started with Yeltsin, the one thing I'll actually give him credit for, but was really cemented and put forward under Putin, and this very strong personal relationship that is evident between Putin and Xi Jinping. The Russian-Chinese border has their legal disputes were settled, almost two decades ago now. They cooperate together regularly under the SCO. Their border is completely demilitarized. Every year you see increases in trade, increased military drills, increased political contracts, cultural connections between the two are growing all the time. The scientific cooperation as well. So the Western geopoliticians' greatest fear is Sino-Russian condominium. That is their single greatest fear. And if you listen to them over the past 15 years, they're like, oh, yeah, Russia and China are cooperating now, but their national interests and everything, you know, China is going to invade and take over Siberia, looking for land. You know what? The Chinese don't want to live in Siberia. I hate to tell this to anyone. China is focused on the Pacific. China is a trade power. China can get what it needs from Russia and Eurasia much easier, you know, meaning energy and natural resources.
They just buy it, right?
By buying it, right, in a cooperative relationship. Right. They've realized that long ago. What they're concerned about is their country, their economy is built on export and trade, which means they need to guarantee the security of trade against naval incursions by other forces and having supply routes of natural resources coming in and products going out from Africa, you know, and to the rest of the world, which means their focus is on the Pacific. Chinese people, that you will see Chinese that will come and work in Russia for a few years, make some money, you know, run some small businesses. Then they go home. They don't want to live in Siberia. The Chinese emigrant waves is to Australia, it's to Singapore, it's to the United States, right? China is looking at being the Pacific power. Yeah. And they've realized the best way they can do that is with their back secured. And Russia leaving China to focus on the United States, and Russia with its back secured against China can deal primarily with Europe. And that is going to be the division of duties between the two of them. Both cooperation, you know, trade, and potential for conflict, right? Because it's not necessary, you know, conflict is not a necessity, right? Yeah, certainly not in the Russian China's mind. They recognize, you know, that we're seeing a multipolar world.
Right.
So, you know.
But it's possible. It may be coming, and they're preparing for it, which is a responsible thing to do.
It's certainly possible. Yep. That's what militaries do is contingency planning. And that's what we're seeing.
All right. So we got to stop here, Mark. And I really appreciate your time. And maybe we could chat about this again once they get the games underway.
Oh, it's going to be continuing. So, hey, read The National Interest, Dave Majumdar, Vostok 2018.
Okay.
Russia set for largest war games in over three decades.
Great. Thank you very much. Speak with you again next week.
Great.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Assassination in the self-proclaimed Republic of Donetsk and the ever-shifting political sands in Syria. And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Crosstalking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in Athens, we cross to Alex Krusiforou. He's the director and writer for theduran.com. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mark, let me go to you first here. We had an assassination of the leader of the self-proclaimed Republic of Donetsk. What should we take away from that tragedy?
Yeah, well, first of all, this was obviously a decapitation, an attempted decapitation strike. It was not only assassination, it was a terrorist bombing. It was a car bomb parked outside a cafe in Donetsk that killed not only the prime minister, but several other people, including a small child. Now, the prime minister of Donetsk, Alexander Vladimirovich Zakharchenko. You know, he started life as a local boy. He was a coal mine engineer and electrician. And, you know, he raised up arms to defend the Donbass when the U.S. the Western-backed putsch overthrew the democratically elected Ukrainian government in 2014 and then began sending its battalions, and eventually the Ukrainian military, once it had purged it and gotten control, to try to subjugate East Ukraine to their illegal and unconstitutional seizure of power. He rose up through the ranks. He was wounded twice in combat. He's the type of leader that led from the front lines. And he at least successfully held the cities of Donetsk and the areas around them. He was regarded as a competent leader, and that's probably why it seems to me fairly obvious that the putsch regime in Ukraine, their intelligence services, are the ones who had him assassinated. Because
what do they gain here, Dima? What do they gain here? What was the purpose here? I mean, to show that these leaders in these breakaway self-proclaimed republics are not safe?
Well, first, of course, the Kyiv authorities deny it. They say that it was all internal strife inside Donetsk People's Republic, or it was Russia. They accuse FSB. But at the same time, they openly celebrate. They openly celebrate that this terrorist act was successful.
Not only that people they had openly called for his assassination.
Exactly. Well, I mean,
before
one of them, Igor Mosichuk, who is a Rada member and who was an active participant in Maidan, just called on the special services of Ukraine to say openly that, yes, we killed him and we acted legitimately because we called him a terrorist.
Okay.
Yulia Tymoshenko said, it's worth being quoted, the God sees everything. The people like Zakharchenko will get their due one after another.
Okay, let me go to Alex in Athens. Well, if in fact the Ukrainian authorities called for this and did this assassination, how in the world should the people in the Don in the Donbass, when I'm including Lugansk, what should there be their perception of the leadership in Kiev be? I mean, they're killing their own people. This man was genuinely popular in Donetsk.
Yeah, and as Mark has noted, he's not the first assassination that has taken place. We've had Gibby, Motorola. We've had many people who were involved in the fighting that broke out years ago who have been assassinated. And we don't know who's done it. So this is not the first time this has happened, and this is probably not going to be the first time that we're not going to be able to understand who exactly pulled this off. But one thing that I was looking at going through the mainstream media, Peter, I saw a lot of articles that placed the blame on three possibilities, as Dima said, Russia, infighting, or some Kiev rogue forces, some
rogue
gangsters. Yeah. No one ever said that Kiev, the government of Kiev, could have been behind this, or the SBU could have been behind this.
Dima.
Well, I think I understand the logic of Kiev if you look at history. You know, the current Kiev regime traces its origin back to the organization of Ukrainian nationalists from the 1930s, 1940s, Hitler's aides. So that organization was decapitated on Stalin's orders. Yevgeny Konovalets, their main leader, was assassinated in Europe in 1936. After that, there was terrible infighting inside organization of Ukrainian nationalists. Bandera's people killed Manulink's people, and it became a lot less capable to fight than it could be expected before the German invasion in 1941. So I think Poroshenko and his people, being Banderites by their ideology, they kind of transfer this kind of psychology on their enemies. They expect real infighting in Donetsk after Zakharchenko, who was an undisputed leader, is assassinated. They want a conflict inside Donbass.
It's basically what Mark is saying, decapitating the leadership.
Yeah, exactly.
This is
first
the purpose.
Of all, the oligarch Poroshenko, the U.S.-backed oligarch, is not himself a Banderite. He just has many of people in positions of authority.
He called himself a Banderite.
Speaker of the Rada.
He called himself a Banderite.
He'll say anything to keep power, right, with those who brought him into power. They did bring him into power, and there are many such figures in the government. Look, Zakharchenko was genuinely popular in Donbass. What's more, he was a capable leader. He was a man's man and an intelligent one at that. The Minsk agreement is falling apart. And unfortunately, the Russian government tried to brush this off as an internal Ukrainian affair, and it threatens the Minsk agreement. For God's sake, the Minsk agreement is dead. This was the final nail in the coffin of the Minsk agreement. He died of a combination of a Ukrainian pro-Banderite regime, too much appeasement, and an excessively cunning plans. This is what kills
Zaharchenko. Okay, let me go back to Alex in Athens here. Well, then essentially this is just putting into stone that this is a frozen conflict that will not be resolved. Because, I mean, if you don't have a partner to talk with, then the Minsk process is a dead letter. And I agree with Mark, it has been a dead letter for a long time. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, and this may be exactly what the government in Ukraine wants, for the peace process, for any kind of reconciliation to not move along. And that's why you're seeing so many assassinations. I repeat, this is not the first assassination. So, I mean, this is extremely troubling to see this, but no one is coming out in condemnation of the Kiev government, because this is happening at the behest of the Kiev government. And one more note, Peter, real quick, on social media, this story is getting suppressed. I've been doing some research, I've been doing some posts of videos and other things, and I'm seeing that the algorithms are flagging anything that you're posting on YouTube, on Facebook, to demonetize it before it even gets published, before they even know what it is that you're saying in the videos.
Fascinating.
They're demonetizing the story.
Fascinating. Mark.
Yeah. They had to get rid of a figure like Zaharchenko. If there was ever any political process to reunify Ukraine between the U.S.-backed Putsch government and the Russian-backed Donbass region, if you put a corrupt figure like Poroshenko on the same stage to debate what has happened in the Ukraine since the 2014 Putsch with a figure like Zaharchenko, that was it. That would be it. You would see the regime completely unravel. And a figure like Zaharchenko would completely dominate and crush anyone like Poroshenko in any type of political debate.
So this is just
like
an extension of no dialogue, no compromise, surrender, and that's it. I mean, this is their mindset here.
Just facts. One important fact. There is Zaharchenko's signature at the Minsk agreements. Formally, these were agreements between France, Germany, Russia, France, Germany, Ukraine. Russia is not mentioned in the Minsk agreements. And Zaharchenko and Plotnitsky, the leader of Lugansk at the time, they were witnesses to it, and their signatures are also there. So they basically killed one of the persons who was a participant in the Minsk agreements. And what is very important is that the Minsk process, the last time they had a meeting in the so-called Normandy format was last August, exactly a year ago. After that, we had another form of dialogue. There was the Russian presidential aide, Vladislav Surkov, meeting Kurt Volker in Belgrade. That stopped in January this year. For 8 months, there was basically no dialogue, except some working meetings in Minsk. Now, after this assassination, we got some very strong language from President Putin. He called it a terrorist act, a treacherous terrorist act. The spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry said that the West was behind it, not only the West was behind the Ukrainian regime, and the Ukrainian regime was definitely behind this
assassination. Let's look at the implications. Let me go back to Alex in Athens. I mean, it's really quite interesting is that, first of all, you had the Poroshenko and his cronies made it pretty well known that they were anti-Trump during the U.S. presidential campaign. You have basically silence coming out of the EU. They have their plate full with their own internal problems here. They've essentially abandoned Ukraine, at least overtly. Is Poroshenko or people around him trying to force something, try to get things back, get them back on the map, as it were, politically, to get the attention of these other players?
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously not moving towards reconciliation, and they're moving towards conflict. And it's no secret, like you said, Peter, that Ukraine was actively involved in helping Hillary Clinton, and Trump knows that, and Trump does not care about Ukraine, and the EU does not care about Ukraine either. But the EU did remain silent on this. I at least expected Germany, France, at least to issue some sort of statement or condemnation. The hypocrisy is terrible. It's incredible what's going on.
Mark.
Yeah. Trump may not like the government in Ukraine, but in a further sign that Trump has no control of his foreign and military policy, the day after the assassination and terrorist bombing, the U.S. envoy to Ukraine, Volker, announced that the U.S. was ready to send more military aid, clearly sending a signal of approval for this assassination, and that the Ukrainian regime should continue in this, you know, manner of assassinating, you know, its own citizens and its opponents. Our condolences to his wife, his widowed wife and four sons that he leaves behind, the people of Donbass and all the people of Ukraine, because they have lost a truly competent and respectable
leader. And, Dima, this has just created a greater divide, if that could even be possible here, killing a very popular leader. All right, gentlemen, on this note here, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, I'd like to go back to Alex in Athens. Let's shift gears and talk about Syria. Looking through the pages of the Washington Post, not because I like reading it, because I have to for this program, we have David Ignatius writing about Syria, and he's quoting an administration official. I suppose we could all play a little game who it is. I think I know who it is. But the official said to Ignatius, "Right now, our job is to help create quagmires, parenthesis, for Russia and the Syrian regime, end parenthesis, until we get what we want." Well, that's really straightforward, isn't it? That has nothing much to do with diplomacy whatsoever. It's making sure that the conflict, the international proxy war that is being played out in Syria, that is coming down, winding down because of the efforts of Syria and its allies, including Russia. It shows the true intentions of the real true colors of the deep state, at least, in their approach to Syria. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, it's a disgusting statement, but it's not very surprising either. I think the worst kept secret right now, Peter, is that there is going to be some sort of chemical attack in Idlib, sponsored by the White Helmets, Al-Qaeda, ISIS. But obviously, no one is reporting on this either, no matter how much the alternative media. Us here are screaming about what's going on. The Russian Ministry of Defense, everyone is talking about the delicate situation in Idlib, the warships moving in, the U.S. warships moving in, the statements from the U.K., from the U.S., from France, that they will attack Syria if there is a chemical weapons attack. It's so belligerent what's going on right now. They just cannot let it go. They cannot accept that Assad has won the war or is about to win the war. They can't accept this.
You know, Mark, it's not my passion to read the Washington Post, and it isn't my passion to watch CNN and MSNBC or the BBC. There's hardly a word about this. But as Alex Christofora pointed out, in the alternative media, this is one of the biggest, hottest topics out there. Yeah. But in the mainstream, it's invisible.
Well, I mean, just look at the title of David Ignatius' article. How to Staunch Syria's Bloody Final Showdown. Well, first of all, it's not the final showdown, because the Syrian government still has the Turkish and American invasions in East and North Syria to deal with. But you say how to staunch the wounds, and then you talk about creating as many quagmires, mm-hmm. i.e. bloody conflicts, as possible, right, until they get the regime change that they want. And, you know, in the article, he goes on to talking about U.S. has enduring interests in Syria beyond killing Islamic State terrorists. No, you don't. You have no legitimate interests in Syria.
Did he enumerate what those interests were? I mean, Dima, mm-hmm. I mean, this is, again, this is the people like John Bolton that want to kill as many birds with one stone as possible. Certainly doesn't want a stable Syria under the leadership of Assad. Would love to give the Russians a bloody nose and to force Iran out of Syria. But none of those things are going to happen.
Well, I like the way antiwar.com put it. They wrote that the U.S. wants a dominant position in post-war negotiations. That's why the U.S. keeps warning Damascus not to attack Idlib, because Idlib is the last stronghold of the Islamists. So, but look, Iraq, if we believe Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden, who wrote an article for them, Iraq is now having probably Iranian missiles moved to it, you know, via the proxy allies. Iraq has allowed the Russian aviation through its territory in 2015, when Russia finally got involved in fighting the terrorists in Syria. So where did all the money go? You know, so much money was pumped into occupying and reforming Iraq. So many people killed. And it didn't work. Why should it work in Syria?
Let me go to Alex, because Dima Babic brings up an excellent point here. There are reports that Iran is moving certain types of missiles with the permission into Iraq, but with the permission of the Iraqi government, obviously. But, you know, if we could tie that in the policy that is being announced indirectly to the Washington Post, is that, where's the learning curve with these people? I mean, you know, the whole point of going into Iraq was to limit Iranian influence in the region, okay? Now what we have, I mean, it's the same people making the same bad decisions, and it always ends badly. But nobody loses their job. No one loses their job at the Washington Post. Go ahead, Alex.
Lose their job. They get promoted, Peter. Some of them are sitting right next to Trump, and they have Trump's ear when it comes to foreign policy. They may be even running the foreign policy of Trump. And I mean, it all goes back. I mean, how can we not forget George Bush, mission accomplished in Iraq. And now you see what's happening today with Iraq, today with Syria. And we're hearing the war drums now with Iran. The same thing over and over, rinse and repeat. And now the target is Iran. So all this news coming out about Iran, whether it's missiles to Iraq, whether it's anything else, it's all about, to quote the deceased John McCain, bomb, bomb, Iran. This is where we're heading, war with Iran.
The idiocy, the geopolitical idiocy of this and the cultural idiocy is just amazing. You invade and regime change Iraq, remove Saddam Hussein, and you get a Shia majority democratic Iraq that makes allies with Iran and invites them to bring missiles into its own country. Why not? The U.S. has missiles all over the world. This short range ballistic missiles.
And Iraq was given its sovereignty back by this coalition of the willing.
You know, these missiles are short range. They're 200 to 700 kilometers. They're just enough to hit Riyadh, Tel Aviv, and the U.S. military bases in Qatar and elsewhere in the Middle East if the U.S. launches an attack on Iran. And that's exactly what they're there for as a backup measure. And why shouldn't Iraq allow it? They're allies with Iran. And you know, they're complaining now about Iranians in Syria. Well, there weren't any Iranians in
Syria
until you funded half the jihadis in the world to try to overthrow the Syrian government. Now the Iranians are in Syria, invited legally by the Syrian government. You don't get to decide who Syria's allies
are. Who would have thought, Dima, just a few short years ago, I mean, the Israelis worried about Iranians on illegally occupied Golan, okay? That wasn't even conceivable a few years ago. Now that's one of their major concerns.
Come on.
I mean, it's really remarkable. Every time they go after Iran in one form or another, it ends in failure for them. And by default, it increases the influence Iran has.
Exactly.
It actually has.
Exactly.
It actually invests very few resources to expand its influence. The West does it for him.
I think the neocons in the U.S. government should be indicted for treason for help spreading Iranian influence across the Middle East.
Good one. Well, it's true. Just a few years ago, Golan Heights was a quiet backwater. Tourists were taken there from Jerusalem because it was so safe. You know, no one could imagine any real military action there. But also, look at what happened in general after these neocons and neoliberals, after they had their operation in Syria. They didn't topple a slightly dissident Syrian regime, which was not really anti-Western. Assad geared Syrian economy to the EU. You know, he was trying to be friends with
the
West.
He was a darling of the West, a neoliberal reformer.
Yes. So they didn't topple that regime, which was not really an enemy. But they lost a much more important ally. There was Turkey, which is now a real dissident inside NATO. You know, and the relations are very bad between Washington and Ankara. So they mess it up every time they want to make it better.
Okay, and you know, in the United States, U.S. Treasury has done remarkable things for the Turkish lira. Let me go back to Alexander. I want to go back to this quote here. Right now, it is our job to help create quagmires until we get what we want. That's really remarkable because usually when there's the regime change mantra, is that we want regime change and then you deploy some kind of military arsenal, an army and planes. And this time it's reverse. They're on the ground now and they're in search of a mission. Quagmires, that is plural, okay? Mischief, go ahead.
In search of a mission and until they get what they want. It reminds me of exactly what's happening inside the U.S., the same people that are upset that Trump won and Hillary lost, and they're going through the motions until they get what they want. It's the same story. They just cannot handle when things don't go their way, even though the policies that they set forth, whether it's domestic or foreign, are just moronic. I mean, they're idiotic, and they never move the way they want them to move. And now, just like you see in the U.S., they're trying to remove Trump. They're trying to find the crime that he did and remove him until they get what they want. The same thing for Syria, until they get what they want.
Brilliant analysis.
And just this week, at the same time, we were presented with the perfect example of such a quagmire. The Russian Ministry of Defense that announced that it had stopped a terrorist attack on Palmyra. They captured two of the people responsible. These militants openly admitted they're FSA affiliated. They were planning bombings in Palmyra, the Lions of the Desert. They say they were trained by the U.S. at the Al-Tanf U.S. occupied military base in South Syria. They were trained, armed, and salaried there to provide terrorist attacks within Syria itself, the type of quagmire that are talked about.
I didn't read that in the Washington Post, Mark.
Well, it actually was in Reuters, but
it was made in Reuters there. You know, Dima, I tend to think that people in the mainstream media and in the deep state, they've forgotten the fear. I mean, I guess I'm the oldest one here of nuclear conflict. Well, I mean, but now they want to go toe-to-toe. It seems to me that they really want to give Russia a bloody nose in Syria. And this is one of the things they can't let go.
Well, they want to give Russia a bloody nose in so many places, like not only in Syria, not only in Ukraine. Just recently, the Canadian Prime Minister announced that he would increase the Canadian contingent in Latvia, of all the places, by 100 men. Why? Because Russia is so dangerous, and they want to give Russia a bloody nose there in the Baltics.
Well, that's Christina
if Russia wants to attack.
Freeland, right?
But I think Alistair Crook put it in the best possible way. Here is a quote from him. Sanctioning the world, the U.S. is inadvertently creating multipolarism. End of quote. That summarizes what Mark has just said, and probably all these people who plan sanctions, you know, who organize attacks or insurgencies like in Syria, they should be given medals by future historians for promoting multipolarism by their own idiocy.
And using the dollar as a political weapon is destroying the value of the dollar and the trust people have in the dollar. Yes. Again, the law of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in Athens. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for our extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules. Now for the extended version of our program where we have political potpourri. All right, Alex Christofora in Athens, you're up to bat.
Well, I mean, of all the media outlets, the New York Times reported that there is a conservative uprising at Facebook. And now the past couple of weeks, we've all known that the social media landscape has been under fire because they are surprisingly very neoliberal, left-leaning. I don't want to say left-leaning completely because they are also banning progressives as well, but they are banning en masse conservative and conservative right pages and channels. And all of a sudden, you had Trump weighing in, and here's the Trump effect. Trump weighs in on the matter. He sends a warning to Google and to Facebook that he, quote unquote, does not like it. And all of a sudden, it seems like you've given the employees who are conservative at Facebook, because I'm sure out of all the tens of thousands of employees, they do have conservatives who are working at Facebook. Absolutely. And they're getting together. They're getting together and they're forming, of all things, a Facebook group, a Facebook page to voice their grievances, to say, you know what, as conservatives, we are being discriminated. And so, I mean, it's just a fascinating turn of events that's going on.
They believe in freedom of speech as long as you have the right speech, okay? Then you're fine here, okay? Mark, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think they ought to do the same thing for actual leftists, vice liberals, that surely there must be a few of them working at Facebook as well, because we've seen Telesaur lose its pages, the attacks on The Empire Falls with Abby Martin, and we've seen seen Craig Murray, right. The, you know, the British diplomat, have you know, all of his archives deleted off
which
of
is
Facebook.
Huge.
And at the same time, Peter Van Buren has been removed from Twitter, and Twitter is now promising a feature to suggest to its followers which news pages they ought to unsubscribe from. Thanks for the advice there, because I really needed to know, you know, particularly, I don't know, in the case of Facebook, what the Atlantic Council thinks I shouldn't be reading.
Wow. It's hire Big Brother to help you out here. Okay. Dima, what's on your mind?
Well, I mean, we had this gubernatorial, you know, preparations for the gubernatorial election in Florida, and it looks like one candidate endorsed by Trump, and the other candidate is endorsed by Bernie Sanders. Well, I won't go into American politics. You guys know them much better. But what is interesting about Bernie Sanders is that he believes in the Russia collusion story. And he doesn't protest against
it. Do you think he really believes it? Or
pretends
just
doesn't
believe. Have the courage to stand up and say it's nonsense?
Well, basically, this election was stolen from him. If it was stolen from anyone, it was stolen by the DNC. You know, he obviously had small chances.
It would give the Clinton a part of the party another reason to push Bernie out, because he's in Putin's pocket. I don't believe Bernie Sanders.
Well, Bernie Sanders isn't actually in the Democratic Party.
Well, he runs as a Democrat. Caucuses, okay,
yeah,
right.
Okay. But when Bernie Sanders says that he believes in the Russian collusion, well, the Russian liberals living in the United States, who would believe that Putin eats babies, you know, who would believe anything negative about Putin, one of them, Konstantin Sonin, a professor in Chicago University, wrote recently that he didn't believe in the Russian collusion story. He wrote it like that: "I still don't see a mechanism through which an operation run by 13 people from St. Petersburg on a $5 million scale can seriously affect the outcome of a campaign in which one side spent $600 million and the other spent more than $1 billion. Well, this is like an early Jesuit saying, I still don't see how auto da fe makes heretics better persons. If Kosonin is saying that, then obviously you need to be really, really stupid or cynical to believe in the Russian collusion.
I think it's cynical. Let me go to Alex here. I mean, I'm following the governor's race in Florida, because it's basically Bernie Bros versus the Trump people. I mean, this is a kind of a what it could have been in 2016 if Bernie Sanders hadn't been cheated out of the nomination here. I think it's possible to elect a socialist in Florida, but I don't think a socialist would be able to govern. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I think he's Gillum is without a doubt a long shot. But the unsurprising thing that we've seen is that this race obviously will not be run on policy. And because of what DeSantis said the other day when he said, you know, monkey it up, he said those terms, all of a sudden it became once again about
identity politics
and virtue signaling. Yeah, so I don't think, once again, I think we're going to move away from policy and what can be done to better Florida and to better the citizens of Florida. It's going to be a race played on identity politics, and that's a shame. It's the way all races now in the U.S. for government are being played, and the Democrats play that very, very well.
What do you think, Mark? And don't monkey it up, okay? I know what that term means. I was brought up with that term. I don't understand. Well, of course I understand why the liberal media reacted the way it is, because they're all triggered all the time.
I'm not interested in the identity politics in the U.S., but what I'm interested in is this is the same phenomenon across the West that we have been talking about, be it in the France, the United Kingdom, in Italy. In the U.S., it's happening again. You had two elitist establishment candidates, despite all the polls, right? And once again, we have evidence that the polls are wrong, dead wrong, right? Because the polls were all wrong on this. Two anti-establishment, populist left, populist right, we'll call it people's left and people's right, defeated two elitist establishment candidates again. And this is the Florida gubernatorial primaries, showing once again that people are tired of this triangulated centrist neoliberal politics that have so little difference between
Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush. Is right. I mean, I think your premise is spot on. But what the establishment parties and politicians lose. They turned it into identity politics, where there is no discussion of policy here. Dima.
Well, I think I know why people are, you know, fed up with politics as usual. You know, at the funeral of McCain, George Bush the Jr. and Obama said that McCain made them better presidents. Well, you know, I leave our viewers to decide whom you have to be for John McCain out of all the people in the world to make you a better person.
Well, he did help them drop more bombs on more countries.
You know, but I think what was most pathetic about the funeral is that, is this the only bipartisan issue the establishment has, is war? That's it. I can't think of any other issue. Alex, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Yeah, can I say something with the funeral that happened for John McCain and for Aretha Franklin? Both funerals, they turned into anti-Trump rallies, both of them. It was unbelievable to watch. And for 2, 3, 4 hours, the main focus of attention was not McCain or Aretha Franklin or any of the people that passed away. It was Trump.
It was war continued during even a funeral.
Yeah,
well, the war continued.
Trump derangement syndrome. Jeremy Corbyn, get real quick.
Okay, there is a truly disgusting and really, really pathetically low smear campaign going to try to prevent the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, to try to dethrone him once again. This is the upteenth time that New Labour and its allies are trying to dethrone him, to prevent him from becoming prime minister, yes, because of the changes he would make, certainly to foreign policy.
The issue is that he's pro-Palestinian, which is painted by the liberals as being anti-Semitic.
They continue, right? If you say that you're against Zionists, you're against Zionists. There are Zionists who are Jews, and there are Zionists who are not Jews, and there are plenty of Jews out there in the world who are not Zionists. Quite clearly, Corbyn, and these are the words are used again, he says anti-Zionist, but he means anti-Jewish. No, it's not race, right? Yeah. And first of all, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I'm aware, the Palestinian people are Semites too, but I mean, that's getting a little nitpicky, I guess. Being anti-Zionist, no matter how much you try to want to make it, is not a matter of being anti-racist, anti-Jewish, or anything like that. Be honest. If you're going to try to smear him, at least admit that you're doing it because he has a policy against a Zionist regime in Israel that is occupying and ethnic cleansing and mass murdering in Palestine. Say we're openly they're anti-Semitic if you count the Palestinians as Semitic, or we're openly anti-Arab, because that's really what it's about.
And so this is, I mean, what's fascinating about it is this: there's a witch hunt against Trump in the United States by the establishment, and there's this witch hunt in the UK against Jeremy.
Foreign policy changes.
The most ardent anti-Zionists and protectors of Palestinian rights are Jews.
Yeah.
They are the most active in the United States.
If you want to talk about Zionists, there are more people. Christian Zionists in the United States than Zionist Jews in the world.
John McCain was a Zionist.
Evangelical Christians, literally believing in the biblical prophecies. Many other currents are a lot more radical on supporting Zionism than a lot of Jewish organizations.
So, than a lot of Israelis.
And then a lot of Israelis.
Just terrifying. Of change. Okay. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we've had here. I hope you enjoyed our extended version of our program, and we'll see you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.